While the Democratic Party is left searching for answers after the election of Donald Trump, the Republican Party also has their work cut out for them as they try to determine the direction they will take under the new president. We'll talk with a political scientist about what the future might hold for both parties and who might fill the leadership gaps left behind by the former DNC chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who resigned in June, and former RNC chair, Reince Priebus, who was just named President-elect Trump's chief of staff. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Where do you think Democrats go from here? How will traditional or establishment Republicans deal with the new president-elect Donald Trump? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. His areas of expertise include American politics, media and politics, campaigns and elections, and election law. He's also the author of about 30 books, including Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, which we discussed with him last November. Good morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you were right that Wisconsin was one of those 10 states that matter, but it went in a different direction, didn't it?
It did go in a different direction. The Republicans had been trying to flip Wisconsin for quite a few years. It was sort of one of those, I use the phrase, firewalls that the Democrats and Clinton assumed they had. And as we know, by the time the dust settled, the day after the election or very late that night, it had flipped to Republicans. And so it really did show that it was one of those states, you know, one of those 10 or 12 states that really did matter in terms of the outcome for the presidential election.
Yeah. Well, let's start with where do the Democrats go from here? As you know, in Wisconsin and other states, Wisconsin goes red for the first time in a presidential election since 1984. A lot of the support that Donald Trump garnered in Wisconsin was what was called working class whites. Maybe traditionally a vote that might have gone to Democrats in the past. Where do you think the party needs to start?
Well, there's a couple things. We have to pick through a couple more things, but I want to stay with your observation about the working class whites, because if we think about where working class whites, especially, I say, working class whites Catholic, traditionally went, since the New Deal, they were sort of a mainstay of the Democratic Party, and also overlay that with oftentimes they were union workers, too. And what was really fascinating about this election is how the Democrats largely lost them across the country, including in Wisconsin. And in part, it seemed as if the Democrats no longer were able to talk to working class whites or to speak in a language that would appeal to them. And when I was looking at the, you know, the Wisconsin map, I double-checked it this morning, and maybe I'm off by one or so, but there were 13 counties that flipped that 4 years ago Barack Obama had won, but now that Donald Trump had picked up, you know, in this election. And, you know, they range, you know, all over the state, you know, but if I look at their characteristics, they are sort of, you know, counties with working class whites. And what political scientists are trying to figure out right now is to what degree did working class whites actually flip? You know, did they really sort of flip over to Donald Trump? And if so, you know, is this permanent or is it a realignment in terms of the parties? Or is it the case that a lot of Democrats just chose to stay home on election day? And there's a little bit of truth to both of those propositions. And I know in the state of Minnesota, if I can draw an analogy here, and I haven't done the analysis in Wisconsin yet, but in Minnesota, some of the counties that flipped wound up being counties where the it appeared that the Republican vote surged, and in the Democratic counties across the state, the Democratic vote didn't quite pick up the way it was. And so we have evidence on both sides, but there's clearly some good evidence there that working-class whites did walk away from the Democratic Party, which means the starting point is how do Democrats going forward figure out how to talk to people who are working class whites. How do they talk to people in suburbs and in rural Wisconsin and rural America? That's the real challenge right now.
Yeah. Well, and over the weekend, Senator Bernie Sanders criticized the Democratic Party, saying that it had focused too much on the liberal elite and had ignored to a very significant degree the working class and the middle class and lower income people in this country. What do you make of Bernie Sanders' assessment?
I think that's essentially correct. I think I've read a couple of really interesting pieces also that point out the fact that to a large degree the Hillary Clinton campaign focused significantly on identity politics, which is important because we clearly know that people of color, Hispanic, and other ethnic groups, you know, are a growing constituency in America, but they're still not a majority. That white working class America or white America is still over 60% of the voting bloc. And if that's the case, and again, from exit polls, we know Democrats largely did pretty badly with that group. Democrats need to figure that out. And what's interesting about Bernie Sanders is, by all accounts, he's clearly very liberal, you know, maybe even sort of beyond the liberal spectrum. But one of the things that he was able to do during this campaign is to meld progressive politics with an effort to try to speak to working class America. And in many situations, that was successful. Certainly not enough to get the nomination, but successful nonetheless. And he also brought in to his coalition, he did well in states where independent voters could vote, as opposed to sort of hardcore registered Democrats. And so I think there's two perspectives that are starting to emerge within the Democratic Party, at least two or three perspectives. One perspective is it needs to be, I'd say, a hard left party, you know, move significantly to the left, but otherwise not change its message. Second, I think, is sort of the argument, which some people will say within the Democratic Party, is that it needs to move further to the right to appeal to more conservative, more moderate voters. And then there's, I think, the third perspective, which Sanders is arguing, is saying that the Democrats have lost their way by not talking about how one can frame progressive politics in a way that also appeals to working class people. And so in some sense, what he's taking us back to is what his primary campaign was and what he's written over the weekend. It's almost the old left of saying that class still matters, that we need to talk to people about economic issues, about class, in ways that resonate with people across racial lines. And I think that's where he's trying to move the party.
Speaking of moving the party, there is an election now to head the Democratic National Committee, and just yesterday, Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison, a progressive, a first Muslim elected to Congress, threw his hat into the ring, and he was garnering support, including the endorsement of outgoing Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid over the weekend. He would face someone like, and there may be other candidates, but former Vermont governor, former DNC chair, former presidential candidate Howard Dean is also seeking the position of DNC chair. Talk some about that juxtaposition. Is that the old versus the new?
It is somewhat old versus new, or sort of maybe new versus newer, or something like that. I'm not sure how I want to describe it here. For your listeners who don't know much about Keith Ellison, let me describe a little bit about him. He's Muslim, African American. He represents essentially the city of Minneapolis and its suburbs. Gets reelected at about a 70% to 75% rate. He probably comes from one of the most solidly Democratic districts in the United States. I've seen some ratings that list him as one of, if not perhaps, the most liberal member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Again, very, very popular within his district, and was also endorsed. He was one of the few, I think, members in Congress who endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. So he represents, there's no question, a liberal wing of the party. What I wonder about him is his capacity to speak to to that broader rural, that broader suburban Democrat that Democrats need to bring into the fold. That Minneapolis, again, overwhelmingly liberal. Its state legislators are overwhelmingly Democrat. But in Minnesota, it's sort of similar to, let's say, Milwaukee proper or Dane County, Madison, is that what the people believe in that area, in Madison and Milwaukee, doesn't necessarily resonate with the rest of the state. And so what I wonder, and I don't know, what I wonder is to what extent Keith Ellison, as head of the DNC, will be able to reach out more broadly to let's say, in Wisconsin, let's say, can he reach out to the Forest, the Lincolns, the Sawyer, the Dunn counties that flipped from Barack Obama to Donald Trump in 2016, versus a Howard Dean, who was one originally espousing the 50-state strategy back when he ran for president, was unsuccessful, of course, who may or may not have broader resonance across the country. And so I think that's the challenge that the Democrats have to figure out is to what extent does somebody like a Keith Ellison, who clearly would make the liberals in the party happy, can he, and really can Howard Dean, formulate a language, message that will have that broader appeal into the areas that Democrats need to pick up.
We will pick up on this conversation after this news. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about what is next for the Democratic Party. And for that matter, we'll take a look at where Republicans go from here, too, following the election of Donald Trump. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We have quite a few callers, so let's take a call for our guest, David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, author of many books, including Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter. Reese in Sturgeon Bay is with us. Hi, Reese.
Hi.
Hi.
So I actually support Bernie Sanders' call for a return to progressive roots in our state and our nation as a whole. I believe that Hillary Clinton turned out to be a complete and utter unmitigated disaster for our state. And I believe that has a lot to do with the message that Democrats have put forward in the last, 6-8 years. And I think if you take a look at the way that the state's primary went, Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders won the state by 13%. If you take a look at the county map, Bernie Sanders won every single county but Milwaukee. But instead, what we get is Hillary Clinton as our nominee. Of course, she was elected to the Democratic primary process. But then what happens afterward? Hillary Clinton pretty much abandons campaigning in the state, sending primarily only surrogates. And then you have not only that, but you also have the state party offices, like the Democratic Party Wisconsin chair, Martha Lanning, who as a superdelegate had originally planned to cast her vote for Bernie Sanders, or pledged to cast her vote for the candidate who won the state, and instead turned back on that promise and eventually pledged to Hillary Clinton. And then she was also the one who ended up signing off on the plan to push state campaign funding to the Hillary Clinton's fund, essentially robbing local area candidacies of the ability to campaign effectively. So what we need to do, at least my opinion as a progressive, as someone who voted in the primary in the general election against Donald Trump, is to just recapture that, because effectively the Democratic Party has abandoned us as a liberal base.
All right, thanks, Reese. So, Professor Schultz, what do you make of that?
I think a couple of good observations here. First of them, I remember Tip O'Neill once said, former Speaker of the House Democrat, he said, never take votes for granted. You have to ask for them. And I think there's a great observation here. To the large extent that the Democrats, especially Hillary Clinton during the presidential campaign, largely didn't campaign in Michigan, in Wisconsin, and in Minnesota, assuming that these were states that were going to go Democratic. And two of the three flipped. Minnesota almost slipped. And there's a sense in which I think the Democrats have taken for granted that they're going to win certain types of votes and have really not campaigned or worked hard for them. So I think that's the first good observation that's emerging there. The second, and I've seen this especially among some of the liberal activists, and I saw this among my students especially. You know, I have millennial, you know, age students. And the sense in which the perception was that the Democratic Party and the elites largely had rigged the election or fixed the election even before it started and threw their weight behind Hillary Clinton. And a lot of my students, I know when I talked to them, said that they weren't even going to vote on Election Day because they felt that that their vote didn't matter, that they really wanted Bernie Sanders, but that the leadership had abandoned them. And so I think these are concerns that the Democratic Party has to address, especially with a rising millennial generation that's going to really retake and remake American politics over the next few years, is that these are people that Democrats have to win over. And I think this election largely alienated a lot of the new generation of voters coming up.
Yeah. So do we have evidence that a bunch of millennials voted for Bernie Sanders and then stayed home because they did not want to vote for Hillary Clinton?
We actually do nationwide. You know, when we look at the voter turnout, we see that among college-level students, let's say even under the age of 30, but certainly among college-level students, the voting this time appears to be even lower than it normally is. And it's not very good generally for college students to start with. And so, yes, we do have some of that evidence in terms of them largely staying home.
I think Greg in Watertown feels similarly to Reese. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Yes, I agree 100%. I think they lost because the Democrats have become corrupt. Look at what happened when Bernie Sanders would have a rally. 10 to 15,000 people would show up, and we didn't see that hardly in the media. Now, that may not be the Democratic Party's fault, but I think the election was rigged. Debbie Wasserman Schultz bears a lot of the burden for this. The superdelegates, the people spoke about what they wanted, and what did we get? We got Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Greg, and that is similar to Reese. Where do the Democrats go from here now?
I don't know. They're going to have to go a long way to regain my trust. They become a party very similar to what I saw in the Republicans that I didn't like, and I really detest the two-party system. We need a third party. We need a fourth party. The system doesn't work anymore. It doesn't reflect what the people want.
Professor Schultz?
Well, clearly, I think both parties, and we'll probably talk about the Republican Party more in a little bit, both parties come out of this election, you know, facing significant challenges. But one of the legacies of sort of, let's say, Obama and Clinton, if I can put the two of them together, if we look at where the Democratic Party was in 2008, 2009, when Obama took office versus it is today, it's a dramatically weaker party in terms of when Obama took office, control of the Senate, control of the House of Representatives, majority of governorships, legislatures, and legislators, they now come out of this a vastly weaker party, and in many ways, a really minority party. And this becomes, again, I come back, you know, almost sound like a broken record here, is that the Democrats cannot just win by appealing to people in let's say, city of Milwaukee and city of Madison, Wisconsin. They're going to have to reach out to a broader constituency of people, those working-class whites, people in the suburbs, try to talk as much as possible to people in rural America. That is the real challenge. What is it in terms of policy that they have to talk about? And I think Trump sort of suggested that Democrats need to be coming back and talking about jobs, about the impact of free trade, about perhaps more emphasis on rich versus poor. These are core issues that I think used to hold the Democratic Party together, and by not talking about them, I think it cost lots of people votes. There's also evidence that there were several million people who voted for Obama in 2008 now voted for Trump in 2016, seeing him as the same change agent that Obama was supposed to have been in 2008.
Let's go next to Dan in Franksville. Hello, Dan.
I think Ralph Nader's been saying forever what the problem is with these parties. So there's nothing new here, but I got a I got solutions, I think, for your previous callers. If you break up the Democratic Party, you have to break it in two, because what you got is low-information voters and people that actually look at the record of people. There's the people for, like, Hillary that listen to the car salesmanship, you know, do this and do that. They don't look at their record, like Hillary's record of hanging around with Madeleine Albright, someone that's basically the same as John Negroponte as far as warring and stuff like that. So the party needs to be split up. And it seems like sometimes I try to figure out, I can't figure out who's the more low-information voter nowadays, the fake conservatives or the so-called Democrats, because at least they didn't get a puppet in. They skipped the fake conservatives skipped the puppet and got Donald Trump, which he's really not a bright guy and stuff like that, but at least they didn't go for a puppet.
Yeah. Well, I think I get where you're going, Dan, but I think he thinks the Democratic Party might have too big a tent, and there are too many different types of voters in that tent. Maybe it needs to be split up. What do you make of that, Professor Schultz?
Well, clearly the coalition that held the Democratic Party together from the New Deal on, you know, were people of, well, eventually became people of color. It became working class. It became unions. It was a pretty diverse coalition. And over, let's say now, almost, what, an 80-year period, 80, 90-year period, the nature of the interests of those groups have changed. And it's inevitable, I think, that political parties, you know, decay and fall apart and have to rebuild themselves. And both the Democratic and Republican parties are at that point, you know, is that we're seeing a passing away over the next election cycle or so, or we've already even seen it, you know, the silent generation born between 25 and 44, the baby boomers are starting to get ready to exit out of the political system, Gen Xers, millennials are starting to come in. So just from a generational change, that's, you know, the parties, you know, need to, you know, to reinvent themselves, but also the economic changes that have occurred in this country over the last 40 years are really driving a lot of how the parties, again, also need to change. Go back to Trump versus Sanders. They both challenged the parties by saying that the leadership was out of touch with the rank-and-file people. And it's not a surprise that what we're seeing, I think in the state of Wisconsin, somewhere around, what, 40% of the population now identifies itself as an independent, that people are becoming increasingly disenchanted by the two parties the way they are. And to a large extent, Trump represented some effort within the Republican Party to change where it is. The Democrats are at that point, too. They need to be rethinking who they are as a party and who's part of their coalition.
Yeah. You know, Dan confused me a little bit because he was saying that low-information voters voted for Hillary Clinton. Don't the demographics say that the voters without a college education, most of them voted for Donald Trump?
Yeah, that's actually correct. That in reality, it was college-educated whites who were more likely to vote for Hillary Clinton. And that's, I think, opposite of what the caller was talking about here, correct?
Let's go next to Cliff in Appleton. Hello, Cliff.
Good morning. I don't fault the Democratic leadership for the way Hillary ran her election at all. I think the message was focused and correct. I blame the American people for making a stupid choice, and I think the disasters to come by selecting someone who talks about, you know, groping women, letting nuclear proliferation flourish, ripping up the Iran deal, denying climate warming. I think that the planet will suffer so much. The people will suffer so much. The people will learn.
So Cliff doesn't blame the Democratic Party. Cliff blames the voters who voted for Donald Trump. Well, what do you make of that, Professor Schultz?
Well, whether he's correct or not, what is it? In the United States, the majority gets to make their call. And part of what campaigns and elections are about is the ability of candidates and parties to be able to reach out and message and to get people to vote for them. And if, in fact, the majority of American public, let me put it this way, if I can't even say a majority because Clinton did win the popular vote. If large sections of the American public or sort of stupid in terms of the way your caller's pointing out here, well, then why were the Democrats and Hillary Clinton unable to persuade them and make the case for them to vote for them? I think at some point the party has to bear responsibility for not being able to persuade people to come over to their side.
Charles on Facebook says, again, somewhat similar to what Cliff was saying, I have been critical of the Dems for abandoning organized labor and the causes of the working class, but it's not as simple as that. Many working class voters abandoned the Democratic Party during the Civil Rights era because of their commitment to racism overriding their commitment to party. So yes, the Dems have to find a way to reconnect with the working class, but the party must not give ground on racial equality and justice. What separates the Dems from today's Republican Party is that we'd rather be on the right side of history even when we lose an election or two. I can live with that. Comment on that?
There is Bernie Sanders. Well, we set up Hillary Clinton. It was sort of a 60s Democrat, where the 60s Democrats represented the emergence of identity politics. Bernie Sanders is a throwback to sort of pre-60s politics, where class is sort of an overriding issue. I think where the future, and where Bernie was trying to go, from what I could tell by looking at some of his speeches and rallies, was trying to merge class politics with identity politics in terms of how do we move forward in terms of both addressing issues of working class politics, you know, middle class politics, but maintaining that commitment to civil rights. And we know that during the 1960s, there were a lot of times where the labor unions were in solidarity, with people of color, with the civil rights movement. But I think part of what's happened is the slowing down of the U.S. economy, the gap between rich and poor that's emerged that we know is, now greater than it's been since the 1920s, has really driven a racial wedge between whites and people of color, where the battle now has shifted again away from class in terms of people competing against one another. So I think the challenge for Democrats is formulating an economic policy, an economic message that at the same time, as the Facebook person says, at the same time figures out a way of still holding people together on that commitment to sort of equality, racial equality, gender equality.
Yeah, there's been some research conducted on how candidates like Governor Scott Walker appealed so much to rural voters in the state of Wisconsin. Those voters apparently feel like their communities are dying, that young people, money, their livelihood, going to the cities. Mm-hmm. The researcher, UW-Madison's Kathy Kramer, labeled the intense negative feelings against people in cities as rural resentment. If you can, talk a little bit on what Democrats need to do or can do to bridge this divide and this resentment.
Okay. First off, what there needs to be across the country, Minnesota, Wisconsin, are serious economic policies that look at, greater Wisconsin, greater Minnesota, that to a large extent we've had urban policies that really are aimed at, at the Milwaukees, at the, at the Minneapolis and St. Paul's, I can use the two states for example, but in terms of thinking of economic development policies that will really help people, stay on the farm, stay in small cities. Whether it's in terms of, I think it's still that way in Wisconsin as it is in Minnesota, things such as high-speed internet access, is in parts of Minnesota which are still dial-up. There are parts of the state where we just don't see really good economic opportunities or resources being committed in terms of infrastructure, telecommunications, healthcare, and so forth. And so I think what we first need are our plans, our economic ideas, education programs, infrastructure investments that move beyond the cities and really extend further into the rural areas across the state. Because until you actually start to develop economic opportunities to keep people back in their homes, across the state of Wisconsin, I think we're going to continue to see that sort of, urban envy or urban, rural sort of, divide. And so part of it is just simply broader economic development that reaches beyond the urban cores that we really have seen, I think, for the last 25 to 30 years.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will continue talking about where does the Democratic Party go from here. We also are going to talk about where does the Republican Party go from here. We now have a non-traditional Republican in President-elect Donald Trump. How's he going to get along with a Republican Congress and what he wants to do versus what they want to do? We'll also talk a little bit about House Speaker Paul Ryan is expected to be reelected today, but not everybody is backing him. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about what is next for both of our major political parties. We spent most of the hour talking about the Democratic Party and its soul searching after the election of Donald Trump. We'll also now talk about where the Republican Party goes from here. Talking with David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Author of many books, including Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter. Professor Schultz, let's move on to the Republican Party. Just a week ago, the prevailing theory was that Republicans were doomed. Trump had no chance of being elected. The down ballot candidates were going to suffer. There was talk about, you know, the Democrats taking over the Senate and maybe then some. Well, that certainly didn't happen. Trump was not only elected, he's going to enter the White House with a Republican-led Senate and House, not to mention a GOP advantage in the majority of the state houses, including Wisconsin. So with that in mind, what's your assessment of the Republican Party at this stage? Stronger than ever, or are there still some fractures?
Both. Mm-hmm. Both. We're going to say both in great shape and in short-term, more dangerous shape longer term. Short term, there's no question they come out of this election, you know, with, as you pointed out, controlling an incredible number of political positions across the country. You know, they control all the federal positions, and by the time they appoint, you know, or let's say all in federal branches at this point, and by the time they appoint, Trump appoints a Supreme Court nominee, we'll have a majority Republican again. So they're going to be in great shape there. But longer term, the Republicans face a real demographic problem. The core constituency or the core base of the Republican Party are people who are coming from what's called the silent generation, people who were born roughly between 1925 and 1945. They are of the most recent generations, the smallest in terms of population, the most white, the most Christian, the most religious, and the most conservative. However, they are also, as you can tell, the oldest, and they are going to be exiting out of the political system over the next few years, replaced by a millennial generation, largest generation in American history, least Christian, least religious, most racially diverse, and the most liberal. And I think the challenge for the Republican Party, even before Donald Trump was being elected, was how they're going to appeal, that is, Republicans, to the next generation of Americans coming up. And I think that is still the problem, that even though for the next couple election cycles, white working class America still remain the majority of the population, that we are seeing this demographic clock tick, and we are seeing changes in terms of what America is going to look like. And the Republican Party, even before Trump, needed to figure out a way of framing a message to appeal to this new generation of people. And Trump perhaps short-term solves the problem, but a longer-term, let us say, over the next decade, problem emerges with the Republican Party still, or persists with them, I should say.
And during the campaign, Trump openly clashed with House Speaker Paul Ryan and other prominent Republicans. Paul Ryan was slow to endorse, and even at the end there was not actively campaigning for him. Did Trump win partly because he was willing to take on his own party? And what does that say about policy passage to come?
Okay, he did win in part by taking on his party because he ran as the outsider, ran
on as the candidate who challenged the party orthodoxy of the Bushes, of in some sense Scott Walkers of the world, by saying that they were out of touch, they represented the leadership. I mean, Trump runs as somebody who's completely outside of Washington, outside of politics, in terms of somebody neither held office nor was in the military. And so I think in part that's how he challenged it, but it is interesting that nonetheless his selection of chief of staff represents, you know, it's the chair of the National Republican Party. So there's an effort to reach out to them. I think to some extent there has been an over exaggeration of what separates him from the rest of the Republican Party. But if we start to look at some of his economic principles in terms of tax cuts, in terms of some of the other issues that he's been talking about in immigration, there's not as much distance between the established Republican Party and him. And so I think there'll be some rough spots. I think there'll be all the problems that normally presidents have in terms of transitions and getting used to becoming president. Plus, Trump will have, I think, some of the difficulties of working with established Republicans. But the fact is, I think there is enough common ground there that they're going to probably find more to cooperate on than they will necessarily find to disagree on.
Paul Ryan is expected to win re-election as House Speaker today, but there are some internal party tensions. There are some Republicans who supported Trump who are saying, Ryan shouldn't be there. Do you expect that to just fade away?
It'll fade away at this point. The fact that the Republicans held on to the House of Representatives will be in part credited to the fact that Paul Ryan was successful in helping, whether or not it's true, helping Republicans keep control. It's generally hard to oust a Speaker of the House when they won re-election. You know, it's the Speaker gets some bonus points in terms of credit for helping him hold on to the majority. And so I think there might be a few protest votes here and there, but for the most part, I would be nearly surprised, if not shocked, if Paul Ryan didn't get another crack at for the Speaker of the House. Now, how long he lasts, that's a good question. You know, whether he lasts a full 2 years or whether or not the effort to try to be a broker between the president, between sort of the House in general and his party and the very conservative wing of the Republican Party, whether or not he can figure out how to negotiate all those different points of conflict is yet to be seen.
Yeah, you did mention the appointment of RNC Chair Reince Priebus of Wisconsin as the new chief of staff in a Trump administration. He also named Stephen Bannon, though, the executive chairman of Breitbart News, as his chief strategist and senior counsel. And that's got to send a message, though, to establishment Republicans that it's not going to necessarily be business as usual anymore.
I think that's true. I think what Trump is trying to do is now figure out how to hold together a different coalition. If part of the difficulty that we used to see, for example, with the Mitt Romney Republican, was holding together the Christian fundamentalist wing of the party with sort of the business establishment, I think now we're seeing a slightly different coalition being trying to held together, which is sort of whatever's left of what we call the mainstream Republicans with sort of the alt-right or with sort of the much more hard right conservative Republicans. And so I think this is a nod by Trump of a way of trying to figure out how to appease both groups in terms of holding together, again, essentially the coalition that elected him. And that may be the new tension in the Republican Party between again, whatever we would call the remaining traditional conservatives versus this new bunch of conservatives. But what I think is fascinating here is that we're not hearing too much in this election or now in the transition about the old Christian right. Now, that's represented in part by Mike Pence, but that seems to be a coalition that Trump is less concerned about than we saw with previous presidents.
Michael in Madison, I'm sorry, Mitchell in Madison is with us. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi. Oh, I just wanted to comment as an independent voter who did vote for either of the two major party candidates. I voted for Bernie Sanders, but I'm not blind to the fact that the RNC did it correctly. Reince Priebus allowed the system to work. allowed the election to happen with the people who wanted the candidate. And I don't hear the DNC talking about that they didn't allow the system to work. They chose a candidate and tried to force the candidate upon the people. So, you know, actually, as independent, I'm not blind to that. It seems like Democrats are blind to it. Some of the Republicans are blind to it, but many of them are had their eyes open and realized that you know, the system needs to work. And the people that are voting for, you know, who they choose should be in office, they should be the voice versus the party arm.
Yeah. And RNC chair Reince Priebus did let the system work, Professor Schultz?
I think at this point we have to do that. I mean, at the end of the day, we have to say that Trump did get elected. I mean, people are upset by the fact that it was a split between electoral versus popular vote. Those are the rules of the system, maybe fair or unfair. Those are the rules of the system. And to some extent, I think we have to say that, Trump is the president, whether we like it or some people like it or not, and we've got to let the system play itself out. The Democrats have to figure out how to respond, and if they can come up with alternative ideas that are better, then it can appeal to people, run like crazy in 2018 and try to take back Congress or the state legislatures where they can. But right now, I think our constitutional system says if people play by the rules, we have to then let the political system operate and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, in our last couple of minutes, we talked some about the election for a new DNC chair. Though, what do you see happening? I mean, I know you don't necessarily have a crystal ball, but we have Howard Dean versus Keith Ellison and maybe some others. But where do you see Democrats going?
Right now, I actually do see Keith Ellison as probably the person who's the favorite. And I say that simply because he will make the liberals very happy within the party. Keith Ellison has strong ties to also the establishment Democratic Party. I'm not sure if Howard Dean captures where the Democrats are right now. Hate to sort of say this, that he's sort of, you know, yesterday's person in terms of for a lot of people. So I would put it there. But going back to all the caveats I raised earlier, to what extent is Keith Ellison able to reach out to those beyond the urban cores, urban enclaves, to reach out to Democrats in the suburban and rural areas?
Any rumblings with in our final minute as to who's lining up to take Reince Priebus' spot to head the RNC?
I've not heard anything yet at this point. That's why I was almost going to ask you if you heard any rumblings, because clearly Trump gets to make the pick at this point. I mean, essentially, because he's now more or less the head of the Republican Party, and I would suspect it will be somebody is to his liking.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Anytime. Thank you.
David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. He is the author of many books, including Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter. Thank you to Bill Martins, to Chris Molina, to Brianne Shasso, to Nyasia Ellison, to Kai Brito for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. It's another edition of On Your Money coming up next, so you can get ready with your personal finance questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.